Hi, this is Alan Chartok, joining us today from the Parker Theater on the campus of the State University of New York. At New Paltz is Dr. Donald Christian, who holds a PhD in zoology from Michigan State University, was recently inaugurated as the 8th president of New Paltz after previously serving as interim president and provost and vice president for academic affairs. Before coming to New Paltz, Christian, an expert in biological and ecological sciences, held various teaching and administrative positions at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, the University of Montana, the University of Minnesota-Duluth, and Michigan State. President Donald Christian, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Alan. I'm delighted to be with you, and welcome back to the New Paltz campus.
Well, as you know, Don, this is a campus that I truly love. I spent 30 years of my life here, and when I think about great institutions, this is right at the top of my list. So it's a great pleasure to be here with you today. Let me start by asking you what zoology has to do with students.
Well, some of my friends have teased me that half a lifetime of handling wild rodents has to be perfect background to be a college president. I worked a lot with students as a professor in for 19 years before I became an administrator, and really learned to love the learning experience for students, and that is a driving force in all that I do administratively.
Could you just remind me for a minute what a zoologist does?
Sure. Studies animals. I'm an ecologist and physiologist by specialty, so I've studied small mammals in forest environments. I've studied forest ecology and management. I've studied desert biology, mostly focusing on animals and their relationship to their environment.
Did you ever get bit?
Many, many times.
What was your worst experience?
My worst experience getting
bit? With an animal.
Oh. Probably one of the most trying ones was releasing a live skunk from a box trap. And my students were sure I was going to get sprayed, but I didn't.
What was your secret of success?
Well, it's sort of complicated and technical to explain.
I had a neighbor live down the road, and I called him. He was a guy who had been alive a long time. And there was a skunk in the bottom of the well house that we bought out in Massachusetts. And I said, how do you get him out of there? He says, well, you reach down and you pull him out by the tail. And you make sure that his hind legs never touch the ground. And if you do, and I said, and when you get him out, what do you do then? He said, then you shoot at the bastard. How much of that was wrong?
There is a small bit of anatomical truth there that if a skunk can't evert its scent glands, it's not going to spray. So the other way you can do this is grab them by the scruff of the neck, hold their tail up between their legs, and they can never spray.
Whoa, that's amazing. I'm so impressed. You see, you thought we were going to talk about, you know, college presidents, things like that. Don, where were you born?
I was born in Ohio.
Ohio. What do you know about the politics of Ohio?
It's been over 40 years since I've lived in Ohio, so I've not tracked it much.
When did you know what you wanted to do, that you wanted to be a professor?
You know, it's real interesting. I wanted to be a wildlife biologist when I started as an undergraduate student, and in my sophomore year, I believe, I changed my major to become a biology teacher. And in my senior year, I said, no way do I want to be a biology teacher. So I changed my major back to wildlife biology, and it's so interesting that my career has involved both of those directions. So I think at some level, both teaching and biological research were part of my career direction very early on, even before I thought about becoming a college professor.
We have an awful lot of deer in the United States,
yes.
And they're carrying a lot of ticks. What should we do about that?
Well, this is a significant problem, and it's one that we could throw tons and tons of money at. I think we need to recognize that a big part of that problem is that we've fragmented habitat, created there are clearly far more white-tailed deer in North America now than there were at the time of European settlement. And we've also removed large predators from the landscape. And that's why we have the deer problem that we do.
What are we doing about all the Lyme disease, do you think? Is there any way we can deal with that?
As long as we have deer and the sort of woodlots that support white-footed mice and acorn crops, we're going to have Lyme disease.
Should we exterminate more deer?
You're really trying to get me into trouble here on the air, aren't you? Sure. Clearly, population control is one of the soundest and most cost-effective ways of keeping that problem under control. And I think we also have to recognize that there are many areas where deer populations are so high that they're impacting the actual survival of certain plant species. And so even though we may object to killing deer, I think we have to look at the ethical responsibility that we may have to those plants that deer are killing, the impacts that deer are having indirectly on songbirds because of their impacts on habitat. So we've kind of played God here, and I know that many people would like to have us not play God in certain ways, but we're already down that path.
Every day, Mr. Bear comes to visit our little house in the middle of Great Barrington. Are there more bear for the same reason? In other words, no predators?
Well, I think bears are doing very well throughout much of North America because of access to food, they're very adaptable critters and can exist in lots of areas, and they grow used to being around humans in ways that in maybe wilder parts of the country where there are more predators, they're not so used to being around people and less likely to come into contact with humans.
Tell me about the student body at New Paltz.
Going from deer and bear to the student body.
I walked around and I saw a lot of bright-looking kids. And I'm wondering, they were always bright, by the way, but they were clean. Something we weren't always used to. No, I don't mean that way. What does the student group look like these days compared to past time?
We have great students. They're bright, they're engaged, they're concerned with the world around them. I ran into a student today on campus who I had visited with, along with other team leaders, for a Relay for Life project that the students planned and executed this past weekend. They had organized 57 teams to take part in the Relay for Life. As of today, they've raised $24,000
Wow.
to support cancer research. So we have our students are engaged not only in their academics, but they're engaged in the community. They relate to bigger causes than themselves. They're actively engaged in intramural and intercollegiate athletics. We have, I think it's 130 student clubs and organizations on the campus that every time we create one of these opportunities, our students flock to it. And it really reflects the sort of intellectual questing that I think is such a distinctive feature of the New Paltz student body, and has been for many years, as you know.
Well, New Paltz, as you know, is the town that time forgot. A lot of people stay here. You know, they never go away because it's such a wonderful place. Does that change the mix of how people react to the college?
I don't know if I've been here long enough to have a real good sense of that. There's certainly a lot of interest in the region and the college. We keep trying to build that. But everywhere I go, I hear a real sense of affection and respect for what happens at the college. And I think some of that may relate to our alumni body. But, you know, I think our most recent statistics show that slightly less than half of our alumni of working age live in the Hudson Valley. So we have alumni all over New York and all over the U.S. and the world.
What is the thing that most keeps you up at night?
How to manage change, and how to manage and lead change in a dynamic environment that's very uncertain for public higher education, and how to lead and manage that change in a way that we adapt to new circumstances and challenges without losing the good in traditions.
So give me an example.
Well, I guess an example would be how do we integrate research and student learning in a way that keeps faculty actively engaged in the life of the mind that models for students an active life of the mind and intellectual engagement that brings into the classroom both the product and the process of research and scholarship, but doesn't have faculty doing that to such a, engaging in their scholarship to such a great degree that they ignore commitments to teaching. And how do we manage the challenges that we face of keeping that tradition alive and active while we're needing to also focus on perhaps shifting total faculty workloads? And so that's a real challenge that is an entire educational community we're trying to figure out how to manage.
That's fascinating. My daughter, now quite grown up, is a professor, assistant professor. And in order to get tenure at her institution, the College of New Jersey, you need a couple of refereed articles published in journals.
Same here.
Is this exactly the kind of thing you're talking about? If that becomes, you weigh it, that becomes more important maybe than being the best teacher in the whole world?
Well, we can't think either or in these kind of settings, because we need faculty who are engaged in their disciplines if we're going to thrive as an institution, and if our students are going to have the kind of faculty to work with that they deserve. So it's a matter of balance. It's also a matter of integration. So the more that we can integrate student learning and faculty research and scholarship, the better off we all are, including our students. So a faculty member who spends an hour working on a research project that involves two or three students is working on the research and their scholarship, but they're also facilitating student learning in the process. And that's a magical combination when we can make it work that way.
Do you believe in the concept of tenure?
Absolutely.
Why?
For the purest reasons. I have seen colleagues at various institutions, I've seen administrators at various institutions come under outside pressure to either force faculty to do a certain line of research or not to do a certain line of research, or to alter their stance on a particular issue. And those are the kinds of academic freedoms that are central to what we do and are part of the central reason for tenure. Now, I will say that I also have seen post-tenure review work very effectively. We don't do that here. I know some institutions have undertaken post-tenure review in ways that help keep faculty sharp throughout their entire careers.
Could you just explain to everybody what post-tenure review is?
Sure. There's this myth, and I'll emphasize that I see it as an absolute myth that faculty, once they reach tenure, sort of quit. And I have not seen that. Many, if not most, of the faculty who I have worked with, and this was my own experience as a faculty member, actually became more productive post-tenure. But how do we keep assuring that faculty are getting the feedback that we all need on our performance to stay on top of our game? And how do we help faculty identify those areas where they can contribute the most to the welfare of the institution and educating our students and to building vibrant careers? And I think we all can use perspective outside of ourselves in helping guide those decisions.
We are talking to President Donald Christian at the State University at New Paltz. Mr. President, what do we have to worry about in terms of access to education for all students? When I went to Hunter College in the Bronx, it was zero. It cost nothing. And a lot of people could come who couldn't afford anything. Now, it's a little bit more expensive compared to the private colleges. It's nothing, but it's still expensive for a lot of people, and it probably means some people won't be able to come. How do you react to all of that?
It's a terrible challenge for us nationally. It's a challenge for our institution as it is for every other public institution. I was at an alumni event yesterday on Long Island with a group of about 30 alums from mostly from the classes of the 1950s, a couple from the class of 1949, and they remembered when they could come to SUNY for no tuition. And were surprised when we explained that the cost of tuition now is just over $5,000, and the cost of coming here for a year is up in the high teens of thousands, mid to high teens of thousands. And puzzled over how students can do this. And we talked about the growing concern about loan debt, which is a concern for us here as well. And we've seen loan debt for students increasing, although we know that a fairly significant percentage of our students here graduate without any loan debt. It's a real issue and a social justice issue in terms of providing access to high quality education for all of our citizens. It's one of the reasons that we're engaging in a private fundraising campaign, of which one of the highest priorities is scholarship support for students, particularly need-based financial aid.
How's that going? Are New Paltz alumni generous?
They are, but it's also a little bit of a shift in culture for many alums of public universities, particularly those who came here when there was no tuition, to recognize that we, like private colleges, need the support of alumni and donors. One of our foundation board members, who is a New Paltz alum, told me that the day he graduated from his private law college, he knew that he would be expected to provide support to that college as an alum. He told me that it took him many years to realize that his undergraduate alma mater, SUNY New Paltz, also needed his support.
How do you change a culture?
Well, we need to begin with helping our students understand during the time that they're here the benefits that they derive from the generosity of alumni who came before them, of friends of the college who support higher education and the needs for access. And I think that's how we start generating new generations of alumni who understand those commitments.
So I do know that the new look in many colleges, particularly state colleges, is that they will become economic engines for the region of the state or the country that they're in. Does that put us at risk for changing the academic mission of the institution?
I think it does if we don't do it the right way. I like to think about that as seeking opportunities for us to enhance the regional economy and provide opportunities for faculty research and scholarship and outreach and student learning in the process. And to the degree that we can do that, it's a win-win for all of us. An example of that would be the sort of research in engineering, for example, that might provide opportunities for our students, that might support regional business and industry, may support business and industry over the long haul by providing our students with the kinds of experiences that would be of value for them to contribute to the workforce after they've graduated.
So, have you ever been visited by a politician with an agenda?
I don't know if there's a college president who hasn't.
What do you have to worry about when they march into your office?
I think how to manage good ideas that other people may have that may not be consistent with institutional plans and priorities without generating ill will in the process.
I think of a predecessor of yours way back who faced two politicians who came into his office and said, "Fire Shartok. We don't like what he's writing. We don't like what he's saying." And he said, "Well, I can't, he's tenured." And he was fired at this institution, maybe not for that, but it's got to be a tough thing to look politicians in the eye and say that they can't have something that they want, maybe to get somebody in, maybe to get somebody hired. I think about all of that.
I will say that I have been pleased that I have not felt those kind of pressures. I had a conversation with a state senator recently about a prospective student who we were unable to admit.
Maybe the same state senator, but go ahead.
I don't think so.
No, okay.
But this was a student who simply did not meet our admission standards, and we had a nice conversation, and I said that I really appreciate your bringing this opportunity to our attention. I hope you understand that I cannot be involved in admissions decisions. I trust the people who know that business to do that work. And that was a conversation that ended quite cordially.
That's wonderful. Frequently quoted maxim of higher education is the only reason academic politics is so dirty is that the stakes are so low. And I wonder, when you come in and you see a fight break out in a department in the school, or you say, "Uh-oh, I really don't want to get involved in this." How do you manage that?
One of the things that I think changes the tenor of all of those kind of discussions is if we shift the thinking from what do I want and what do you want to what's best for our students. And that really redirects much of the tone and direction of those academic political battles.
But why do those battles have to happen? They always happen. You know, there are three guys in a room and everybody has a different position. And it can get very heated. In all your years at these institutions, what is it that in the academic psyche that causes that?
We're academics. We got interested in this business in part because we're independent. We have ideas. We like to pursue those ideas. There's a certain ego strength, I think, that has to be there to be successful as a faculty member and certainly as an administrator. I think those are the kinds of features that we have traditionally seen in academics that fuel some of those arguments.
We're talking to President Donald Christian of the State University at New Paltz. Don, I wanted to ask you about the way in which roles occur. You were a long time provost. What is a provost? A lot of people listening don't know what the provost does. And what's the relationship between the provost and the president?
I read in a book about academic deans that the provost is sort of like the dean, except even more remote and terrible.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I read in a book once that, never mind. You don't want to hear that, but go ahead.
Typically, provosts and vice president for academic affairs are combined into a position, and that's the nature of the position here. And that person fills the role of being the chief academic officer, responsible for supervising deans, responsible for overseeing all academic programs in their delivery, is the chief personnel officer for faculty and other academic personnel, so oversees hiring, evaluation, promotion. The provost part of that often is interpreted to mean the first among equals among the vice presidents, who often is the first to step in if the president is away from campus, responsible for making decisions in the president's absence. So those are the typical kinds of roles and responsibilities in those positions.
So what do you find different about being president than being provost?
Well, I was only provost for 1 year, so certainly, the external face of a president is very different than that of a provost and vice president for academic affairs. I have learned so much last year as interim president, and I continue to this year, about the complexity of keeping an institution like this running well that goes far beyond academics. Facilities issues, personnel issues outside of academic areas, planning, student affairs and student life issues, the business of managing our enrollment, those are complexities that provosts may touch on through their interactions with vice presidents, but in different ways. At the president's level, all of those things tend to come together, and you realize that they're all essential for having an institution be successful.
How hard is your job?
You know, I used to say that being an academic department chair was the hardest job in a university, because you're a faculty colleague one day, then you have responsibility for supervising people who perhaps 3 or 4 years from now you're going to go back to being a colleague again, and that's a very difficult job. I made those statements before I became a college president.
Do you have any plans to go back?
To being a faculty member?
Yeah.
No. I love the classroom, and I love interacting with students, and those are the kinds of things. You know, when we move from position to position, as you know, we give things up. And that's one of the things that I know I've given up and that is a sacrifice. But I also know that there are also bigger institutional challenges that need to be wrestled with. And frankly, they're intellectually very engaging, they're challenging, but dealing with complexity at the level of a provost or a president really, I have to say, has me intrigued.
Across the river, there's a small liberal arts, not so small liberal arts college anymore, Bard, and the president there spent a great deal of time, I know it, trying to get money, and very successfully. State University, theoretically, has some funding that comes from the state, but it's less and less, isn't it?
Yes.
So do you find, as a result, that your job is more and more raising money?
Certainly, it was made clear to me during the provost search, or the president search last year, and as it was to me even as interim president, that whoever's going to be successful here as a president needs to lead the institution in generating more private funding. I try to manage my calendar in a way that I have a day and a half or 2 days a week devoted to that work. I haven't quite achieved that yet, but that's the long-term goal.
How do you do it? Pick up the phone and start calling people, or how does it work?
No, it's really building relationships. Building relationships and affiliations with the institution, helping people understand the way that private support can make a real difference in the lives of students at the institution and in the success of our educational enterprise.
But sooner or later,
you got to ask.
I was going to say, the president has to make the ask.
Well, no, many gifts come to the institution without any presidential fingerprint on them. And I think that's an important point for all of us to recognize.
My wife going back to Skidmore, the classes as they go back are expected to make a gift to the college. Does that happen here?
Mm-hmm. Modest. This year, the senior class gift is students are asked to donate $20.12, because we're in the year 2012, and they as a result of that gift, they're given honor cord that they can wear at commencement. Different color than the academic honor cords, but it's a way of, in the development office and student leaders develop this approach to the senior gift. It's a way of helping those students both give to the institution, but also begin that thinking about a culture of philanthropy.
I'm very proud of New Paltz being one of the most selective, if not some years, the most selective part of the state university, hardest to get into. How do you capitalize on that? I mean, I use it all the time when I talk to people, but how do you capitalize on it?
One of the ways that I communicate about that is to convey to prospective students and their parents that one of the most important ingredients in educational quality is the caliber of one's classmates. Because, and I think faculty here would tell you, long-term faculty would tell you, that they're able to teach at a higher level when they have a class of more capable and more dedicated students. Significant parts of learning are social, and being around other students who are bright and engaged and committed is an essential part of a great learning environment. And we see that here.
So do you have to fight to maintain that status of yours? In other words, right now I think it's Geneseo, which is a fine place, but I count on a little bit because it's smaller and has some specialized programs that make it desirable. Binghamton, I once had a girlfriend there, and I don't think much of that. and then New Paltz. That's extraordinary. It just is. What does it do to? Is it the fact that you're 90 miles from New York and 90 miles from Albany? Okay, no, I'll change that. 90 miles from New York. You didn't think that was a joke?
75.
Well, yeah. 75, 90, whatever. Oh, we'll cut this part out. Okay, so So what is it that makes it so desirable?
Part of its reputation that feeds on itself. We have administrators and faculty who talk about experiences at our open houses for prospective students. 10 years ago or 15 years ago, they would often hear parents say, when my son or daughter comes to New Paltz. And now what we hear more often is, if my son or daughter can get into New Paltz. So the reputation is growing, and that's a key part of educational value is the as I point out, the caliber of the students in the classroom. It's also, I think, due to the great reputation that the institution has based on the work that our graduates do after they leave here and go into the world.
At Harvard or Yale, there's such things as legacy admissions. Do we have legacy admissions at New Paltz? Legacy, for those who aren't aware of it, is, you know, your father went there.
We admit every student based on their own credentials and qualifications, but it's quite stunning to see that we have multiple generations of students coming to New Paltz. One of the alums that I mentioned yesterday told me that his son had come here in the 80s and his granddaughter is coming here next fall. So we're seeing more and more of that, but each of those students is admitted on the basis of their own qualifications.
When I came to New Paltz in 1971 full-time, there was a designation by the State University, I believe, that we were going to be the African, as in Africa, and some of the Near East majors. That's what our designation was. But faculty members here, like my colleague Jerry Benjamin and some others, decided that they were going to make this place into a political science haven, which it became. How much is just serendipitous with all of this?
Oh, it's all planned.
You got the University at Purchase, which is supposed to be this great art center, and yet students flock to New Paltz to be part of the arts program. And that happened because of the serendipity of a few people like Kurt Matzdorf, the great gold designer, and the rest coming here. So, you know, and once it takes hold, it sort of goes forward, doesn't it?
It does. And I was being facetious. I think
No.
the energy of a core group of faculty to build quality and to push ahead to build strong programs is a key part of much of the flavor that institutions and particular programs take on at institutions. But we also have to be planful about how we do things. For example, we have the only engineering program in the Mid-Hudson Valley and the only one at a comprehensive institution like this. We also have, as you have pointed out, these unusually distinctive arts programs, and we have real opportunities to build distinctive programming in arts and technology, and we're doing that. It's growing out of faculty interest and energy, but it's one that the institutional leadership is also embracing as a unique way that we can contribute. So I think it's often an interplay between intentional planning that will help bolster great ideas that come forward from the institution.
I remember when one of your great predecessors, Alice Chandler, decided that she wanted an engineering school here at New Paltz. And as I remember it, I hope I'm right, the private institutions, which had some hegemony on that, decided they didn't want New Paltz to have an engineering school. And she went out and she fought like hell. Got IBM to sign on, got all these other people to sign on, and it was a real political brouhaha. And I'm just wondering whether you see anything like that looming in your tenure.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because we're actually looking at some program diversification in our engineering program. And
yeah, you had a promise you would do certain kinds of engineering when you got the designation, is that right? Is that what you're leading
up to? That was long before my time here, but I believe that's the case.
Okay.
But I think there's enough recognition now of the need for more engineering opportunities as an economic development resource in the Hudson Valley that there'll be there's stronger political support for us to diversify our engineering program. So I've been trying to get a handle on those political dynamics as we move ahead in those directions.
What's the what's the relationship these days between the town and the gown? You know, New Paltz, the institution, and the town of New Paltz? It's a broad question.
Yeah, it's a very broad question. I think there are many people in the community who recognize that much of the special flavor of New Paltz as a village and a town is due to the presence of the college, and welcome and value the college as a great resource, culturally, socially, economically. There are others who, I think, resent the fact that the college, as a state entity, doesn't pay taxes. There's some sense that the college contributes to traffic issues in the town and the village, even though our municipality's own studies on traffic flow show that the college is a minor contributor to traffic congestion here. So I guess I would say the relationships are mixed, but we work very hard to maintain positive relationships. We have a regular town gown group that meets once a month. It's a communication mechanism between the college, including the president's office, communication in government affairs, student affairs, campus police, interacting with the New Paltz police, the village mayor, the town supervisor, the rescue squad, the fire department, other municipal entities. And so we're working very hard to keep those relationships cooperative and supportive and to work together.
We're talking to New Paltz College President Donald Christian. Don, I guess I'd like to know about when you mention college to a lot of people, the first thing they think about is marijuana. What's going on?
One thing I would say is that New Paltz has the strictest drug policies in our student judicial code of any of the SUNY campuses.
Really?
Yes. We're a college campus. Students use marijuana as people in the community use marijuana. We educate as much as we can. We take judicial action when students get into trouble, try to help them get support for drug problems in usage.
So, you know, are drug problems growing or are they decreasing? What's your sense of it?
I don't have a sense that they're growing. I don't have a sense that they're decreasing.
Tell me about the college police. A lot of places are now debating, should college police carry guns? Should they be armed? You know, what their relationship with the student bodies are. How do you deal with that?
That's a really tough duty because they're officers of the law and they're policemen, but they're also, in a sense, educators. They're working with a population that's a certain age group that's testing boundaries, learning how to navigate the world. And our officers, I think, do a remarkable job of enforcing the law, maintaining public safety, protecting students and others on the campus, but also recognizing that educational role that they need to play.
I'm sorry, help me with the educational part of it.
our officers have a presence on campus trying to build close ties with the student body. Some of our university police officers teach courses in self-defense and rape attack prevention.
Fascinating.
So those are some of the roles that our campus police play. Work very closely with New Paltz Police and with some of the merchants in safety programming.
How do the businesses in New Paltz live or die by what goes on here at the college?
How do they?
Yeah, in other words, is it your sense that without the college, there would be the town would have far less than it has? And do they come? Do those leaders come and visit? Those business leaders come and visit upon you and make suggestions?
We have a number of business leaders in the community who are part of our Business Advisory Council. We try to maintain good relationships there as well. I think everybody's aware that students and their families, when they're visiting, spend a lot of money in New Paltz. So I think it's clearly recognized that the college is a key part of the local economic environment.
From time to time in college campuses, there have been, you know, ethnic issues. You know, people of color having a sense that they're not well treated, that kind of thing. While I was at New Paltz, there was a certain amount of that going on. What's your sense of the state of those relations now?
We had an unfortunate incident on campus this fall, a posting of a racially motivated sticker over a drinking fountain in one of the academic buildings. And it generated anger and puzzlement because this is a very diverse community. People seem to be very accepting of each other. And there was a little bit of shock and a little bit of surprise that something like that could happen at this campus. I had a conversation recently with somebody at a major private university in the western half of the U.S. and described this incident. And she said, oh, yes, she said, we're down to having maybe 8 or 10 things like that happen on our campus each year.
Something like that just happened at Williams College.
Yeah. But the remarkable story there, I think, is the way this campus community pulled together both to condemn those acts and to learn about what we can do to create a more equitable and inclusive climate. And that's a process that's going to continue for some time.
But is your sense that this is a volcano or that this is just something that is not as important as it may have once been?
I think race and racism remain serious issues in the U.S. that we don't like to talk about, don't like to deal with, and I think we need to, and I think college campuses are a prime venue and opportunity for having those difficult conversations.
How important is it that the students at New Paltz register to vote?
Very.
And how do you take that as part of your mission?
Well, this is a challenge for all college campuses, is educating students for civic engagement. And we encourage students through our encouragement of student governance and the role that students need to play in governing their own parts of this campus. Our students are actually, I find, amazingly engaged in local issues, state and national issues as well.
Yeah, but what percentage do you think of this college turn out? Okay, so you don't know.
I don't have that figure off the top of
okay,
my head.
Right. However, I do know that college campuses, there used to be a joke, the only way you get them out to vote is with a bomb. So I'm wondering whether or not we're making any progress on that, because I do see that the President of the United States is touring college campuses as we speak, trying to energize young people to vote. And I wonder if you think college administration...
We had a primary site right here on the campus on Tuesday. I don't know the turnout there.
So is it a job of a college president to make that happen?
If a college president can do that by encouraging participation in the process without encouraging a particular political view and direction. And I think it is an important role for all of us as educators to encourage student involvement and participation and knowledge about how we govern our affairs as a democracy at all levels.
Do you watch television?
Rarely.
If you watch television, what do you watch?
I have to say it's probably been months and months since I've had commercial television on.
Public television?
I honestly...
Don't turn the television on.
Don't turn the television on.
What do you do? I watch Law and Order all the time, so I was just wondering, what you do.
Well, I've started watching we watch a documentary now and then. I read a lot.
What do you read? Zoology, or do you read, you know, contemporary stuff?
I read fiction now and then. I read a lot of stuff about higher education and presidential leadership. I read some history. I'm getting more and more interested in New York history.
What do you think about what you've learned about New York history? Do you think there's a time when a New Yorker could be president of the United States again?
Probably not until 2016.
Really? And then, what's your view as to who that candidate might be? Because I keep hearing, Senator Gillibrand said the other day that she was going to be the first one to sign on to support Hillary Clinton to run in 2016. And then today, or yesterday, Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver, said basically that he thought she would make a tremendous candidate. And she said, and so would Andrew Cuomo. So if I asked you which of those two, Andrew Cuomo or...
I would tell you that it's a wise course for college presidents to not make statements in public about political candidates.
Drats. Obviously, the State University, as everybody else does, has to lobby.
Yes.
You have to go up there and you have to ask for money. I've interviewed Chancellor Zipfer lots of times on how all of that works. Have you had your baptism in that yet?
Oh, yes.
And what was that? Tell us what that was like.
It was actually, it's an interesting process, and I see it as more an educational opportunity than as lobbying. And I've found the state legislators who I've interacted with to be receptive. I understand the many competing challenges that they're dealing with, but we've worked hard to establish good relationships, to share information as we can, to make the case for the needs for public higher education in New York.
So do your students come from Long Island? Where are most of the students who come to New Paltz generated from?
About 40% from Long Island in the New York City boroughs, about 40% or so from the Hudson Valley, 7 or so counties, 4 or 5% international, and the remainder from a few other states, other parts of New York.
Tell us a little about the international program.
We have wonderful international programs. Students here from many countries. We have wonderful study abroad programs, both those that we administer at New Paltz that attract not only our students, but students from other SUNY and other campuses. Our students take part in some of the other study abroad programs that other SUNY campuses run. We have collaborative ties with institutions in Spain, France, multiple institutions in Turkey. We have a large contingent of Turkish students coming to New Paltz through a dual degree program, mostly in business and economics. Key part of what we do.
Is it your impression, because it was never mine, that enough students take advantage of all these wonderful programs? I mean, you know, we run the Legislative Gazette program, as you know, up in Albany, and we get some wonderful students who come up there. But it takes a little doing to get to go to Spain or to go to France or to do all of that stuff. And I was always somewhat disappointed that we didn't get more who wanted to do it. What's your impression?
We have by national standards, we have a fairly high percentage of students who study abroad, but it's not enough. And it would be great to have every student have some global experience, whether it's a study abroad or an international experience here on the campus. We have, for example, a wonderful Chinese language and culture living learning community on the campus. In one of the residence halls, students from China, our U.S. students who are studying Chinese language live and learn together. The U.S. students help our Chinese students learn English. Our Chinese students help our U.S. students learn Chinese. We're going to be expanding that in the coming year to include Japanese as well. So those U.S. students, even if they never travel abroad to study, will have had an international experience here on the campus. We want to keep growing those opportunities. We also want to keep developing the programs that facilitate and encourage our students to study abroad. Nationally, for example, it's a challenge for many institutions to encourage students of color to study abroad. And we've developed some wonderful programming through our Educational Opportunities Program, Center for International Programs, some other offices that's been recognized for the sort of mentoring that we provide for students of color studying abroad.
Wow. Do you want to tell us about how you make determinations about what goes and what stays? What I mean by that is SUNY at Albany has had to make major reductions in some of the things they offer. I believe German, the teaching of German was one of them, which has led to a lot of reaction. Have you faced one of those situations?
Not with an academic program. We, as I think you know, we faced a $6 million plus budget reduction last year.
And what's the total budget of the college?
The total budget of the institution is about $116 to $118 million. What we call our core instructional budget, which pays faculty salaries, pays my salary, the provost, the dean's salaries, that's about $57 million, and that's the one that to which taxpayer support goes, and that's the one that we cut $6 million plus from last year. It's the one that the administration also had to cut $6 million from in 2008 and 9.
How'd you do it?
Well, one of the programs that was eliminated in 08 and 09, as you know, is a nursing program. Last year, we focused very heavily on non-academic, non-instructional programs.
What's that? Give me an example of that.
Well, one example is that we realized that we had been budgeting for energy and utilities about $1 million more each of the last several years than we were spending. So we reduced that budget line as part of our reduction. A little scary, given the uncertainty of...
Because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. So that's one example. We've been looking at ways that we can do our work more effectively. So if we have a place where four staff have been managing an operation and we had an opportunity to eliminate a position and figure out how those three remaining staff could do their work more effectively, or if there's a piece of that that's simply had to be set aside as lower priority and decided something we don't do, we did that. Compounded those sort of changes across the institution. But it really means, and we're still working on this, continuing how to do our work with high quality, but do it differently.
What's the future looking like these days? Do you anticipate more cuts, or do you hope that things are sort of set for a while?
We're in the wonderful position last year and this year of having new tuition revenue to invest. We have been directed, and this would be my moral and ethical inclination, even if we were not so directed, to invest the tuition dollars that students and their family are investing in increasing course access, instructional capacity, and related functions that support student success. So that's where we're directing the bulk of those resources. The SUNY system is looking at different formulae for how the state taxpayer allocation and state resources are allocated to different campuses. And we don't know how that's going to play out.
In other words, some of us are afraid that, maybe not you, but me, that more money will go to the university centers than go to colleges like New Paltz.
That's certainly a fear that some have.
And do you get a chance to express yourself on that issue?
Oh, yes. And one of the ways that we express ourselves on that, my comprehensive college presidential colleagues and I is continuing to reinforce the point that we graduate about half of the baccalaureate recipients each year in SUNY and well over 40% of the master's level graduates across SUNY. So there's a big educational enterprise in the comprehensive colleges.
Well, if there's any way I can help you out, be sure to ask.
I sure will.
Our guest has been Don Christian, who is the president of SUNY at New Paltz and obviously doing a great job. Let's give him a hand. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam.
I told you I didn't know what I was going to ask. Anybody got a fast question? Good. Great. Well, we're going where now? To the
NPR, in the student union.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.